This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up, tomorrow's the anniversary of the sinking of the Titanic. We'll listen back to a conversation we had in 2008 with one of the founders of the Titanic Historical Society in Springfield, Massachusetts, and we'll listen to some archival audio of survivors. But first, the unsung legacy of pioneering African-American journalist Ethel Payne. Known as the First Lady of the Black Press, Payne fearlessly reported on America's civil rights movement. Today, we'll learn how she documented history while also breaking down journalism's race and gender barriers, making history of her own. You can join the conversation, 860-275-7266. Again, our phone number is 860-275-7266. You can comment on our website, WNPR.org, or you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Joining us is the biographer James McGrath Morris. His book is called Eye on the Struggle, Ethel Payne, the First Lady of the Black Press. He'll be speaking at the Harriet Beecher Stowe Center on April 22nd at 7 p.m. If you'd like to find out more information about this event, you can go to harrietbeecherstowecenter.org. James McGrath Morris joins us from KUNM in New Mexico. Thank you so much for joining us here on Where We Live.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be with you.
What drew you to Ethel Payne's story?
Well, Ethel Payne's story is one of, as a biographer, was one of those irresistible stories, a story that would tell itself, and sadly had not been told. And so, when I began to look into her life and realized what an extraordinarily significant role she had played in American history, it seemed an inescapable cause for me to take on.
You've written about journalists before. As you looked through the list of famous American journalists, her name certainly came up. Are you surprised that people hadn't really tackled her substantial story in this way in the past?
Well, I was surprised, but I guess it was partly naivete. I mean, one of the things I discovered working on this book and writing about the African-American press is, like so many institutions in African-American life, operated in complete invisibility to white America. So while she became the premier journalist for the Chicago Defender, and the Chicago Defender is not just merely a Chicago newspaper any more than the New York Times is merely a New York newspaper. She did this incredibly important work in raising issues of civil rights to the national agenda, reporting from the front lines of the civil rights movement in Montgomery, and yet for 85% of Americans, she remained unknown.
Hmm. Her story, as she became this pioneering black journalist, is a fascinating one, in part because she didn't start right away as a journalist. Can you just quickly take us through her early work and her early career, which really is much more as an activist than as a journalist?
Yeah, well, in a sense, she had no choice. She was born in 1911, raised in Southside Chicago. And what she discovered after getting quite well educated was that the chances of a black woman in the 1930s finding a professional job in Chicago was the same as a warm day in the middle of the winter in that town. In fact, 7 out of 10 African-American women in the 1930s who held jobs in Chicago held jobs as domestic servants. So activism was, in a sense, not a choice. She felt the only way that she and her friends could get ahead was to become an activist, and she did so very early. She worked with A. Philip Randolph, who famously started the March on Washington movement in 1940. People always think we're talking about 1963, but that march had began 23 years earlier. And she worked with the NAACP and constantly used, you know, her experiences, having every door closed on her, every no told to her, as trying to turn those into yeses. And finally, she broke into journalism by, of all things, going to Japan, where she worked as a service club hostess for the American troops who were occupying Japan at the time. And a number of events led to her having her first publication at age 40 in the Chicago Defender, an invitation to become a reporter there, and began her career as a reporter very late in life, as she was 40 years old.
And again, you've mentioned the influence of the Chicago Defender. I grew up in Pittsburgh. The Pittsburgh Courier, of course, was another one of these great national black newspapers. But I think for much of the American population, certainly of 2015, there's not an awful lot known about the scope, the influence of these publications. Can you spend a moment explaining why the Chicago Defender in particular was such an important publication at the time, not just for African Americans, but to chronicle history?
Yeah, well, the Pittsburgh Courier in your hometown was eventually bought by the publisher of the Chicago Defender, showing the power of the Chicago Defender economically. The Chicago Defender was started in 1905 as a consequence of segregation. You know, when African Americans began moving in large numbers to northern cities, life was better, but they remained deeply segregated, and they were excluded from the economy of Chicago. So in Bronzeville, the nickname for part of Southside Chicago where African Americans were forced to live, being excluded from everything, they created their own institutions. They had their own jazz bars, their own taxi companies, their own funeral companies, their own cosmetic companies, and their own newspapers. And the economic basis of the newspaper was segregation. The Chicago Tribune and other papers simply were not covering the African-American community. And by covering it, they would, of course, write about crime, but they wouldn't write about the stuff that makes newspapers in those days, such as high school graduations, funerals, obituaries, weddings, all the stuff that we turn to newspapers for. So the Chicago Defender had a natural role to play, and it created its economic basis, but it became nationally significant in its national circulation. Folks in the South would get the Chicago Defender, and remember, the South between World War I and World War II was highly feudal in a sense that African Americans in one county might not know what was going on several counties away or several states away. So the Chicago Defender was chronicling the injustices, the lynchings, all the kinds of things that Ida B. Wells had done in the 19th century, informing folks in the South of what was going on and it being endemic, and also telling them what was going on in the North, which helped trigger the mass migration, which is so beautifully portrayed in Isabel Wilkerson's book, The Warmth of Other Suns. But getting the Chicago Defender in the South was a tricky proposition, because some counties actually made it illegal. And forget about law. You could actually lose your life or have your house burned down if you were caught reading this rabble-rousing, dangerous newspaper. So you weren't going to get this weekly newspaper by mail because the mailman would report that you're getting the paper. So Pullman porters who traveled the United States, these were uniformly African Americans who serviced the Pullman trains, cars. These were cars in which, John, if you were traveling back to Pittsburgh now, instead of flying, you would get on a train and go overnight and be well cared for and arrive well rested. These men would carry the newspapers with them to the South, leave them in towns, usually in barbershops, and on Saturdays when men would come in to get their shave and their haircut, they would take the Chicago Defender home with them, fold it up carefully so no one would see it, and that's how the word was spread. So when she joined the Chicago Defender in 1951, this was a terribly significant newspaper for the African-American community from all the way from the South to the North.
We're talking with James McGrath Morris, whose biography of Ethel Payne is called Eye on the Struggle, Ethel Payne, the First Lady of the Black Press. And he's going to be talking about her story at the Harriet Beecher Stowe Center on April 22nd. And we'll have more information on our website, WNPR.org. I want to bring into the conversation Farai Chidea, who's a professor of journalism at NYU. She's the author of several books, including Don't Believe the Hype, Fighting Cultural Misinformation About African Americans, a revised edition of this book coming out next year. Farai Chidea, welcome back to Where We Live. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, John.
First of all, I'd like to ask you about the story of Ethel Payne. As James suggested, this is a story that is in many ways well known, but not as chronicled perhaps as it should be. Can you just give us a sense first of the power, the impact that she had as a journalist, as an African-American advocate, just all the things that she did over this very long career?
Well, I think James paints an incredible portrait of her life in context. I mean, she was someone who was a woman of so much strength and so much adventurousness, who went to Vietnam, who ended up breaking into the networks and working for CBS and, you know, doing things that black ladies weren't allowed to do at the time and still, frankly, have quite a hard time doing today. The news media, as I have written about and documented, has not become materially more integrated at the highest levels, and in some cases has become actually somewhat more segregated, particularly at print publications at large. So we are not living in some kind of post-racial era, but she set up a system whereby both the black press was taken more seriously, which, of course, is a mix. You know, there's a sort of aftershock effect to the era of integration, which is that a lot of the black press diminished in, you know, importance and in circulation and audience. But still, without the black press, there would not be black people in mainstream press. And there still are strong African-American news outlets today. But I would also point out that, you know, Ethel Payne is part of a tradition of women who have really also been standard bearers. There's people like Ida B. Wells who wrote about lynching, and she was also an advocate and a journalist, you know, someone who in addition to many other things, you know, took a stand on a train sitting in a segregated section and, you know, was kicked out and filed suit against the railroad. So she wasn't afraid of taking stands in her personal life as well as her professional life. And she traveled to Europe to speak about her reports on lynching. And then you have people like Delilah Beasley, who was a columnist in the early 1900s for the Oakland Tribune. And she actually got white newspapers, which would regularly use these words, to stop referring to black people as darkies and the N-word. So she changed the nature of language around race. So I think that there's a long tradition of black women who have provided a foundation for those female journalists who continue today.
You know, Farai, one of the things that is really important about Ethel's story, and actually the stories that you've told about these other pioneering African-American female journalists, is the sense that I talked about with James a moment ago, that the activism, in a certain way, can never stop. That even as you are a journalist, and you teach journalism students right now, that in her life, in the places she was, in the work that she did, you can never really stop being an activist in that way. Can you just talk that through as a journalism professor, as someone who has written quite a bit about the way in which the news media has changed over the years, about that balance of someone who is standing for something while they are reporting objectively on what they are seeing with their eyes?
Well, see, I don't believe in objectivity, and I will tell you why, and I talk about this a lot. I believe in fairness. So I've interviewed Klans people, other white supremacists. I've interviewed murderers, drug dealers. I am not objective about how they're leading their lives, and they're probably not objective about me and how I'm leading my life. But when I interview them, I'm fair. I try to present them as fully-fledged human beings and get to understand why they're living their lives the way they are and then write or broadcast something that's accurate about why they're living their lives the way they are. And I think that's what makes me a good reporter. And I think that a lot of times racism in the newsroom, which, you know, like sexism, is far from stamped out, masquerades as objectivity. And what I mean by that is that if the standard of American society includes a lack of dialogue around race and a lack of perspective on gender and family and many other issues, if you norm to that, that's not really objective, but that's actually what happens quite a lot of the time. So it's viewed as objective if you kind of go with the norms of the time, which is why you had all-white newsrooms until the riots of the 1960s, and it was considered perfectly fine to have all-white newsrooms until the norms changed. So I'm a big fan of being, I wouldn't even call it an activist, but, you know, someone who stands in your place and you understand where you come from, but also has compassion and empathy and tries to understand other people as you do your work. And I think that all of these women and many other great reporters of all races do that. So I wouldn't frame it as activist, but more truth-telling.
And that's, James, I think one of the important parts of the story. It is about truth-telling. It's not about the objectivity that so many of us, the false objectivity that so many of us see in newsrooms today. But in that way, it seems like the work that Ethel Payne was doing actually was groundbreaking at the time and is not replicated in many newsrooms today. It's almost as though she's part of a dying breed of journalist that really does look at what's happening and fairly reports on it, not objectively, but in a way to get at a truth that really matters to the people who are reading her work.
Well, when Farai mentioned objectivity and fairness, I rushed to my book because here's something Ethel Payne said 60 years ago. For black journalists, particularly me, I think it made us know that we could not stand aside and be so-called objective witnesses. We were absolutely unable to make the distinction between what is objective journalism, so I adopted a code of trying to be fair. And I think that's really important. I think this objectivity is kind of an excuse often for why things are covered or not. And yet, everyday news operations, whether it's WNPR or the New York Times, make decisions merely on what it is they're going to cover. That is not objectivity. That's a decision that's deeply political and deeply social. you know, one of the great powers of journalism that Ethel Payne and others used is merely the ability of a publication, a news media of any sort, to light the dark recesses of our society, to illuminate injustices, is an extraordinarily powerful weapon. Ethel Payne never had to resort to the kind of stuff you hear on certain networks today, where people are using vitriolic adjectives and yelling and screaming at each other. She covered some of the worst segregationists in this country, and she covered them fairly, because what they had to say, they would hang by their own words. She didn't need to elaborate. Her viewpoint was clear, because as an African-American in Washington in the White House press corps, any question she was going to ask was going to affect her. She described herself, this is the language of the 1950s, I could not divorce myself from the heart of the problem because I was part of the problem. In the 1950s, African-Americans and others used that language of the Negro problem. We wouldn't use it today. But the point is that when she stood up and daringly asked questions of Eisenhower, and people today don't understand, and that's why Farai's point about women today and African-Americans today in the press is really important, the courage that it took for a black woman to stand up in a hall and ask a white president a question when women were thought to be should be passive, for an African-American woman to do that and then see 200 male white faces turn around in the hall and stare at her as she's speaking is an enormous act of courage, equal in some respects to going to Montgomery and risking her life. So my point is that when she was doing these kinds of things, her viewpoint was clear. She wasn't asking about what the First Lady was going to have for lunch. She was asking for the paramount issue that affected her readers. And that's why she thought this whole business of objectivity was really a kind of myth-making that permitted newspapers not to cover things rather than to be forced to cover them.
We're talking with James McGrath Morris, who's the author of Eye on the Struggle, Ethel Payne, the First Lady of the Black Press. Also joining us is Farai Chidea, who's professor of journalism at NYU. And we're talking about this pioneering black journalist. We'll be talking more about the issues surrounding her work and bring it forward into modern times and what you might think of some of the coverage today of, say, Ferguson, Missouri. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today we're talking with James McGrath Morris, who's the author of a new biography of Ethel Payne. It's called Eye on the Struggle, Ethel Payne, the First Lady of the Black Press. We're talking about this pioneering African-American journalist. Also joining us today is Farai Chidea, who's professor of journalism at NYU, whose books include Don't Believe the Hype, Fighting Cultural Misinformation About African-Americans. A revised edition is coming out next year. One of the stories, James, I wanted to get to is the differences that you enumerate in your book about the ways the black press that Ethel was a part of, the way they covered the civil rights movement and some of the civil rights bills that were signed in Washington versus the way the overwhelmingly white press covered these exact same issues. And there really is a distinction, isn't there?
There is, and as a white historian, to me, it was one of the great learning moments of having spent several years studying Ethel Payne's life. To put it simply, when the white press covered the 1957 Civil Rights Act, which was a really gutted act, but nonetheless it was passed, the 64 Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act, significant legislative victories, the white press tended to portray these as munificent gifts being given to African Americans. But if you read Ethel Payne's coverage and you read the general tenor of the black newspaper's coverage, nothing was being given. These were rights that were owed to them that were being won by their actions that were being taken. So one, it's a very different portrayal. It's much more, to make it simply, like the Selma version, movie version of everyday people at risk of their lives obtaining things that were owed to them as opposed to being given to them. But also the limitations of those acts were portrayed very carefully in the newspapers and in the press of that time. I mean, by that, the African-American press. So parents of mine who were white Washington liberals and very typical of people who would have supported Johnson and Kennedy later during urban unrest in the 60s, they would ask questions at their dinner tables. Well, what else do they, meaning African Americans, want? We've given them all these things. And that's the portrayal they obtained from the Washington Post, Newsweek, and Time magazine and New York Times, whereas African Americans clearly understood that they hadn't been given anything. They had won a number of advances, but many of the key advances remained unfulfilled, which is why Ethel Payne so carefully covered the People's Campaign, Poor People Smart Campaign in 1968, which would have been the last part of the victories to be obtained. But again, it's a portrayal of people rising up to obtain what's owed to them as opposed to being given to them. I'd be curious if Faraya shares that view of her study of the Black Brides.
Faraya, I wanted to ask you about that. And importantly, in the context, too, of the coverage we see today of what has happened in Ferguson and Staten Island and most recently in South Carolina, there is a sense still that the overwhelmingly white presser, we'll call the mainstream press today, has maybe a very different idea of what rights are owed to African Americans in America today, even today in 2015, than an awful lot of African Americans do themselves.
Well, I will say that the good thing about this relentless stream of killings at the hands of law enforcement officers or citizen vigilantes, as in the Trayvon Martin case, is that people actually are evolving. I mean, like, the conversation on Fox News is evolving. The conversation in the New York Times is evolving. And I think people are moving. I'm not saying that things are perfect by any means, but things are moving from the kind of immediate reaction of, you know, was this person a thug? Was he or she unarmed? To an acknowledgement that, you know, and Charles Blow wrote about this, like, you know, Walter Scott is not on trial. Like, if you're shot in the back and framed with a taser laid beside you, your moral values may not be 110%. You might not be going for the Pope, but it's kind of undeniable that something really bad just happened. And I think that there were so many moments where the victims were put on trial publicly and in these really shameful ways. And I think that that's changing slowly. But I think there's always been a difference, not just in the, you know, kind of what's being said, but also the complexity of what's being said. And so there's this phrase, Black Twitter, which, you know, people are starting to write about in academic context as well as other things. But it's like there's this world of social media where people archive articles, discuss articles. It's almost like, you know, a consciousness-raising session that's happening in social media. And it's a really fascinating development in society.
James, how do you think that Ethel Payne would have acted, reacted, worked within this media landscape of today that Faraya is describing?
It's always the task of a biographer to be asked to channel their subjects. You know, it's hard to know. Payne was always at the core an activist in the sense that she used journalism to advance the cause of civil rights while remaining true to the tenets of being fair. And I suspect she'd be doing the same thing. She'd want to be on the scene. The hardest thing for her in her life was when she got old, was being viewed as an icon, being referred to as the first lady of the Black press, which meant that she was no longer a working reporter. So I think if she could, with her cane and other health disabilities, she'd be on the scene trying to convey the complexity that Faraya is talking about to her readers.
Mm. Faraya, do you have a thought on that? It's always hard to put someone from the past into a present day, but do you have a thought on how she may have acted or reacted in this world that we're talking about?
Well, I wouldn't presume to know more than James on that, but I do think that, you know, one thing I would say is that one thing that's happened in the news industry is that for economic reasons, a lot of times we see journalists with the most experience kind of being put out to pasture before they have finished being useful. And that, to me, is a great shame. Like, when I came up in journalism, I learned from people who had covered, you know, the Vietnam War, Watergate, et cetera, and now I think I worry that someone like Ethel Payne, were she alive today, wouldn't even find a space in a newsroom, you know, at all.
And unfortunately, so many of the spaces in news organizations today reserved for talking heads who want to shout at each other, maybe not the thing she'd want to do. We talked today with Faraya Chidea, a professor at NYU. Her books include Don't Believe the Hype, Fighting Cultural Misinformation About African Americans. Thank you so much, Faraya, for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks to James McGrath Morris, whose book is Eye on the Struggle, Ethel Payne, the First Lady of the Black Press. He'll be at the Harry Beecher Stowe Center on April 22nd. Thank you so much, James.
That was a terrific conversation. Thanks for including me.
Coming up next, we'll hear more about how you can support WNPR. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up tomorrow, it's our weekly news roundtable, The Wheelhouse. Hope you can join us. Tomorrow is also the anniversary of the sinking of the Titanic. Now, there's no shortage of Titanic history available, but one of the biggest and oldest organizations keeping this history alive is right in our backyard, Titanic Historical Society in Springfield, Massachusetts. They were founded in 1963, and they call themselves the world's largest Titanic organization, with more than 4,000 international members. They've also been involved in collecting and recording the voices and stories of those who survived. We're going to listen back to a conversation we had in 2008 with Edward Kamuta, one of the founders of the Society. It was a favorite conversation of ours, but we recently learned that he passed away last year in April of 2014. He was 74 years old. Edward Kamuta, welcome to Where We Live.
Good morning.
So what got you so interested in the Titanic that you founded this society in the first place? Talk a bit about the society and its history.
It began in a short story that I read in junior high school in 1952 called A Great Ship Goes Down by Hanson Baldwin. And the very next year, my father, who owned the local Grand Theater in Main Street in the Orchard, played the movie Titanic with Clifton Webb and Barbara Stanwyck. And that really ignited my interest in it. And a few years later, A Night to Remember was screened, most expensive black and white movie made in Great Britain at the time. And they sent to me an information booklet which contained names and addresses of the survivors that they had been able to find. And I wrote to every one of them. And when one of them died a few years later, all of his material was thrown on the city dump by his landlady. And I said, somebody's got to form some kind of an organization to preserve this material. And so I wrote to all the survivors and told them what I was up to. And before you know it, contributions started to come in the forms of various memorabilia.
So many of us, of course, know the story or parts of the story from these many, many movies and all these accounts. What are some things we don't know about this trip that perhaps, I don't know, maybe the movies get wrong? Tell us a few things, Edward, that perhaps if we just saw the 1997 movie with Leo DiCaprio that we just wouldn't know about the sinking of the Titanic.
Well, the movie itself was great. Of course, my wife and I had a walk-on part in the movie, and Mr. Cameron and his people came to us for technical data on it. And it was a good love story, but it could never have happened the way they depicted. You would never get a third-class passenger on a first-class deck, for example. And the sets in the movie were wonderful. They're the best that I have ever seen of any movie ever made. And they rebuilt the Titanic down there in Rosarita Beach, Mexico, you might as well say. And then they broke it all apart as the ship was sinking. And, of course, they unfortunately let some of the myths go onto the screen, like Bruce Ismay trying to get the captain to light up those last four boilers and this type of thing. And it's too bad they let that slip in.
So you've collected all of these Titanic artifacts over the years. What are some of the most unusual artifacts that you've gotten from people? What are some things that you're proud of having preserved?
Well, we have the original life jacket worn by Mrs. Astor. She wore that particular night, and that was given to us by a descendant of one of the doctors who were on board the Carpathia. When she was in the lifeboat, she yelled up to those on board, "If you will help me out of the lifeboat and tend to my medical needs," because she was with child, "I'll give you $10,000. And the medical officer said all she left behind was her life jacket, so I kept it. So we have that in our collection that he donated to us. And we have one of the lifeboat flags, a metal lifeboat flag that was on one of the lifeboats, and along with a deck chair. And I think the most poignant thing that I have in the collection is the discharge book from Frederick Fleet, the man who actually saw the iceberg and reported it to the bridge.
You know, it's interesting because, as you say, so many people are interested in the Titanic because of all these accounts and all these movies. And as you suggested about the 1997 movie, and I'm sure the earlier movies as well, it's a very glamorized account. But these survivors' stories that you've collected, some of which we're going to hear in just a moment on tape and just that you've gotten through correspondence, these are the real stories of real people, and that must be somewhat humbling to have all of these real stories about how this event affected their lives.
Yes, that was one of the purposes I sent out to when I established the Titanic Society, was to try to get as many accounts from these people as we possibly could, because as the years took their tolls on their minds, they could not remember very much anymore, so we had to capture it while they still were able to recall it. There was one lady, Marjorie Newell Robb, of the Boston area, who did not talk about the Titanic tragedy for the longest time. And finally she was interviewed by Reader's Digest, and she talked about the terrible foghorn that was going off all the time, and the panic of the people, and when the ship hit the iceberg, she was thrown off her bed and all this type of thing. Most of this didn't happen. She had seen the 1953 film with Clifton Webb and Barbara Stanwyck, in which they had the horn blaring and all this, and all this just worked itself into her mind.
Let's hear a little bit from one of the accounts that you provided to us. This is from a Mr. Frank Goldsmith, and this interview was conducted back in 1973. He's a Titanic survivor. Can you tell us anything about this particular piece of tape, Edward?
Frank was a youngster on board the Titanic, and he was leaving for the United States with his mother and his father. And I met Frank. He was one of the very first survivors I ever met. He walked into our store one day and introduced himself. And I was just flabbergasted. He was the first one, as I said, I ever met. And quite recently, my wife has put together a book on his life called Eyewitness Story. And it's a very poignant story of a third-class passenger who was put into a lifeboat by his father. And his father stood back to die with the other brave men.
Let's hear a little bit of his story right now. This is tape recorded back in 1973. Frank Goldsmith.
Mr. Goldsmith, how old were you when you were a passenger on the Titanic?
9 and a half. I'm able to remember everything that happened as clear as if it happened yesterday. Of course, the day went on, and night came, and I was put to bed, went to sleep, and the next thing I knew, I wakened and I was half-dressed. Mother was putting my clothes on me, and so we walked out of our cabin at this time. All of us, and there were five in our party. There was Mother and I and Dad, young Alfred Rush, and a friend of my dad's by the name of Tom Theobald. And anyway, we went on up and got up onto the promenade deck, then up another flight of stairs to another deck. And there was a gateway there through which they were permitting only the women and children. And Dad put his arms around Mother's shoulder, hugged her and kissed her, reached down and squeezed my shoulder and said, "So long, Frankie, I'll see you later." In the meantime, the crewman had reached to grab young Alfred Rush's arm to pull him through, because he was 16 years old, of course, but he wasn't a very large boy. But he jerked his arms out of the man's hands and said, "No, I'm going to stay here with the men." Unknown to me at the time also, Mr. Theobald had taken his wedding ring off his finger and had given it to Mother and said to her, "If I don't see you in New York, see that my wife gets this," and she, of course, was still in England. And slowly we walked towards the front of the ship on the port side and got to the last lifeboat. And we got aboard this lifeboat and were slowly lowered after a while. And I learned later from Walter Lord that it was 5 minutes after 2 when that boat was lowered, and it turned out to be the last lifeboat to leave the ship. And because of the tilting, the gunwales of the lifeboat began to catch on the plates of the ship, and we almost got tipped out. And that happened 3 times before we finally got to the water. Now, when we got down into the water, we could look back and see it, and lights were all aglow in the portholes and on the mastheads. The noise that we did hear later, the terrible crying that we heard, occurred shortly afterwards because there was a slight explosion, and Mother caught my neck under her arm and forced my head into her breast so that I couldn't see that ship go down. But after she had held me a few minutes, I could hear all these cries. And the cries sounded to me like it sounded when somebody hits a home run at a baseball park. And we lived within a mile of Navin Field in Detroit, which was where the Tigers were. And every time I heard that noise, it made me remember that sinking. And then Mother let me go, and I could look back there, and I could see the Titanic's tail end. aimed right straight at the sky. You could see the outline of the rudder. The sea was as calm as this floor. But you couldn't avoid seeing that outline of that boat, and slowly it began to sink. I lost my dad, and Alfred Rush, of course, also died. So did Mr. Theobald.
That's the voice of Frank J. Goldsmith, interviewed back in 1973. It comes courtesy of the Titanic Historical Society. The founder of the Historical Society, Edward Kamuta, joins us here on Where We Live as we talk about the history of the sinking of the Titanic. The part of his story that I think resonates with me is this idea that the sound that he hears of all the people screaming is something that he relived every time he heard a baseball game, every time he was in a large crowd. It's amazing, and I'm sure you have heard lots of those stories, Edward.
Yes, I have over the years, and Frank's is the most touching of them. And, of course, when I listen to the Red Sox and somebody hits a home run, I think of Frank.
Before we run low on time, we have another piece of tape, one of these other interviews that you've collected over the years. This was recorded back in 1957, and this is Mrs. Frederick Kenyon. I'm wondering if you could quickly tell us a little bit about this interview and who she was.
This is one of the interviews that was taking place at one of our conventions, and she was a survivor of the Titanic, and I think she tells it well in her interview.
Let's hear a bit from this.
When we came down to dinner, the captain's table was the first inside of the dining salon, and next was the first mate's lightola. Well, our table was bedecked with flowers, and Captain Smith, coming in a few moments later, came over and asked, "Is this a bride and groom?" And we explained to him it was just an anniversary. He congratulated us, and in a short time, the steward brought over a huge bottle of wine. That was our introduction to Captain Smith. He seemed always to stop us and call us the bride and groom. It really was a lovely friendship. On this night, I think we retired about 11 o'clock. Well, after retiring, I don't think I was asleep, but we heard a sort of a bump, not a strike or not a severe hitting, but we knew something was wrong, so we both got up and partially dressed. The corridors were filled with people, but the stewards and officers walked along telling everyone, "Don't be excited, there's nothing to be feared. We have struck an iceberg, but everything's all right. Everything will be all right." And we rather took it for granted. And we walked a while and leaned against the staircase that went up to the top deck where the captain's cabin is. And Captain Smith evidently saw us down this way. He said, "Is that you, Kenyon? Well, come on up on deck." Captain Smith didn't stay very long with us. He kept going into the little cabin and conversing and telephoning. But he came back and he said, "Mr. Kenyon, I'm going to speak to you." And my husband left me and went and spoke with Captain Smith and came back and said, Captain Smith said he'd feel lots better if all the women would go on the little boats. And I started my old song, "I Won't Leave You." Captain Smith went to the edge of the boat, and he whistled. And a boat came up, and he and my husband helped me over into it. And I sat in the middle of two men on the front of the boat. My husband turned abruptly, and he turned right, he wouldn't look at me. And the boat was lowered. They rowed towards the northwest. I don't know how long the boys rowed, but after a while, this boy sort of looked at me kind of funny. He fell forward. He just doubled up at my feet. Well, I was a pretty good sailor myself and could swim hard, and because we lived on the ocean front at Noank, Connecticut. So I just slipped over and took the oar. It was pretty heavy, believe me. But I rowed. We kept on rowing all night long. But about, I say, 25 minutes after we left the Titanic, She simply turned up her nose and went down. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Then, as you all know, we finally came up with the Carpathia, and we were lifted aboard.
That's the story of Mrs. Frederick Kenyon. It was recorded back in 1957, courtesy of the Titanic Historical Society. Edward, we just have a little bit of time, but as I listen to that story, I really understand why this history has captivated you so much over the years. It's amazingly emotional stuff. Do you think that more people will continue to become interested in this, or do you think that over a course of time people are going to start to forget about this? I mean, once people forget about the movies and some of the history that we've seen in the movies fades away, do you think people will still be interested in this?
My wife Karen put it to me. She says, you've wanted to keep this memory alive and keep it before the public. She says, I think you have accomplished your goal. She says, after the movie and everything else, people won't forget now.
That's Titanic Historical Society founder Edward Kamuta from a WNPR interview in 2008. He died last year at the age of 74. If you'd like to find out more about the Historical Society, go to titanichistoricalsociety.org. I'm John Dankosky. Thanks for listening to Where We Live.